Hello and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, Security is Paramount in Medical. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with speakers Andrew Longhurst from Wittenstein and Mark Pitchard from LRA Software Technology. Andrew is a business manager at Wittenstein. He's a skilled project leader with an extensive background in electrical, electronic, and software engineering. Andrew has in-depth understanding of the challenges facing embedded engineers with safety-critical sectors. He has worked in medical, aerospace, and automotive since 1993 and has worked for Wittenstein since 2000, developing flight-qualified systems with a focus on quality assurance. Andrew holds a BE in engineering, electrical and electronic engineering, and a Master of Science in Robotics and Automation. Mark Pitchford is a technical specialist with LDRA. Mark has over 25 years of experience in software development for engineering applications. He's worked in many significant industrial and commercial projects in development and management, both in the UK and internationally. Since 2001, he's worked with development teams looking to achieve compliant software development in safety and security critical environments. Mark earned his Bachelor of Science degree in Nottingham Trent University, and he has been a chartered engineer for over 20 years. Welcome, gentlemen. We are to the housekeeping here before we start with our presentations. Today's schedule will consist of a presentation followed by a Q&A. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some important features of your viewing console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This will maximize the slides to fill your entire screen. The Download Slides button allows you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box enables you to participate today. You can simply type your question into the box and submit it using the Submit button. You can submit questions at any time during the presentation. We encourage you to do so early and often while you're looking at the material and the question is fresh in your mind. We'll address as many of these as we can during the closing Q&A. And if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you can submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to respond to you during the eCast. This and all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Andrew will be kicking things off today. Andrew, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Kurt. I'm Andrew Longhurst, business leader for Wittenstein High Integrity Systems, a company that specializes in the supply of safe and secure real-time operating systems across multiple application domains, one of which is medical. Within the medical sector, our most popular product is SafeRTOS. Over the next 20 minutes or so, I will briefly explain my thoughts on how good embedded systems engineering practices with a holistic approach to security can reduce vulnerabilities in medical devices. Connected medical devices have many benefits. They offer opportunities for continuous monitoring, telemedicine, and big data analysis to uncover hidden trends. However, with connectivity, there is always a risk that bad actors could gain access to medical devices with potential life or death consequences. A quick search of the internet for medical device security breaches will result in multiple reports of vulnerabilities in insulation pumps, infusion pumps, cardiac defibrillators, and pacemakers. Notably, former US Vice President Dick Cheney's doctors disabled his pacemaker's wireless capability to thwart possible assassination attempts. We have also witnessed recently entire hospitals in the US and UK shutting down for multiple days to combat ransomware infections in critical systems. The bad actor's advantage is they only need to find one successful attack vector, whereas the defender must defend all possible attack vectors. As attacks evolve and get increasingly novel, aggressive, sophisticated, and frequent, defenses must be continuously refined, improved, strengthened, and hardened. It should be assumed medical devices operate in a hostile environment. Medical device developers should expect constant attempts at intrusion, and therefore products should be hardened to meet this threat. But how? Let's start with development standards. Guidelines and standards for developing secure systems are limited. However, the FDA has recently issued sets of guidance focusing on medical device cybersecurity. with the FDA recommending manufacturers use the National Institute of Standards and Technology framework for improving critical infrastructure cybersecurity. An alternative standard that could be considered for medical device security is Common Criteria. Common Criteria is a widely recognized international scheme used to assure security enforcing products. It provides formal recognition that a developer's claims about the security features of their product are valid and have been independently tested against recognized criteria to a formalized methodology. Without going into too much detail, Common Criteria requires a security target, which defines, amongst other things, the security objectives and the environment the device will work within. The system is then designed and verified according to a specific evaluation assurance level, or EAL, which there are 7 altogether. For each EAL, there is guidance on the methodology the design, verification and penetration testing should follow. The higher the EAL level, the greater the effort required, which should also result in greater determinism and security for the device under test. Certifying a medical device to Common Criteria has its challenges. However, even if Common Criteria is not adopted in full, the guidelines and methodologies used by Common Criteria could be of use to medical device developers concerned about security. Next, let's move on to the development lifecycle that could be used to build in both safety and security. All medical device developers are familiar with safety, but for many, security is a new subject. Safety and security share many properties. However, these similarities can be dangerous, and if handled incorrectly, can result in the wrong design decisions being made. The current slide shows a high-level representation of a safety-critical design lifecycle, commonly referred to as the V model. The next few slides provide examples of how this development lifecycle can be altered to design in security as well. Within the development lifecycle, security and safety require similar yet different processes. To identify safety requirements, you need a highly structured technique such as a HAZOP, whereas to identify security requirements, you need to ignore the limitations of the structured environment and consider all contexts that are possible within a surface attack analysis. The attack surface analysis is used to understand the risk areas in a medical device, to make developers and security specialists aware of what parts of the medical device are open to attack, to find ways of minimizing this, and to notice when and how the attack surface changes and what this means from a risk perspective. In some ways, designing for safety is easier. The device works in a known context, and if the context moves outside of its defined operating parameters, then the system is placed into a safe state. Security is more difficult to ensure, as the attacker is attempting to manipulate the system's context to gain access to it. The danger is that a context that was impossible to conceive during the design is presented to the system, resulting in unwanted side effects which might leave the system open to attack. Driven SAR, safety and security cannot be considered in isolation. There are unwanted interactions between safety and security, and sometimes this can include unwelcome side effects. For example, an alarm system that automatically opens the doors to allow evacuation of a building could also be manipulated to allow an attacker to gain access to the building. In a high integrity design lifecycle, the attack surface analysis which results in a set of security requirements could be performed in parallel with a HAZOP which results in a set of safety requirements. Not forgetting that safety requirements should also be subjected to a security review, and security requirements should also be subjected to a safety review. Next, let's consider coding standards. Most developers of safety-critical software are familiar with MISRA C coding standards. Its aims are to facilitate code safety, security, portability, and reliability in the context of embedded systems, specifically those systems programmed in C by providing a restricted subset of standardized C programming language that is deemed to be safer. There is an alternative coding standard for secure programming called CERT-C, from the Software Engineering Institute. Cert C details coding guidelines for those developing software that requires a degree of security. Cert C provides rules and recommendations which, when followed, results in less vulnerabilities for the bad actor to exploit. I believe there's a growing trend to use Cert C within secure systems. Testing for security requires a slightly different approach. Fuzz testing is used to identify hard-to-predict security vulnerabilities within the software. Fuzz testing involves providing invalid, unexpected, or random data as inputs to the software module or application. The module or application is then monitored for exceptions, such as crashes, or failing built-in code assertions, or for finding potential memory leaks. An effective fuzz test will use semi-valid inputs that are valid enough in that they are not directly rejected, but do create unexpected behaviors deep in the application that are invalid enough to expose corner cases that have not been properly dealt with. Penetration testing is used to evaluate the security of medical devices. The test is performed to identify both vulnerabilities, including the potential for unauthorized parties to gain access to the system's features and data, as well as its strengths, enabling a full risk assessment to be completed. A penetration tester will identify a specific security objective. Then we'll review all available information to construct tests that attempt to undermine the security objective. It may seem unfair that the tester has access to the design documents, but there's no guarantee that a bad actor won't also have access to the same design documents. Having software is both safe and secure is an interesting maintenance challenge. Safety software takes a long time to develop and verify, is robust and reliable, and consequently is rarely updated. Whereas the security threat is constantly evolving, with attacks growing in complexity as hackers learn and develop knowledge on how to exploit the software. This results in software being regularly updated to counter attacks. The software design should take this into consideration, whereby dependencies between safety and security code are minimum, and the security code can be updated with little risk to the safety of the system. Now, moving on from the development lifecycle to implementation, the next three slides address vulnerabilities that are normally identified during a medical device surface attack analysis. Medical device security relies on a series of nested objectives. As these objectives build upon each other, it's vital the initial objective is implemented in a highly robust way, which is very unlikely to be compromised. In most instances, the initial security objective of a medical device is to confirm the device has booted, is the correct device, and that the software of the device has not been compromised. This is normally referred to as the root of trust. The root of trust is typically implemented using a dedicated security module implemented entirely in hardware, or a combination of hardware and software integrated into a security coprocessor. This creates a secure mechanism for developers to lock down their code. Each time the system boots, the system validates that the digital signature of the booting code. Only proven authentic software can execute. Attacks that modify the system software are detected and blocked. The actual code booted depends on the application. It could be just a bootloader is initially authenticated and installed, and this bootloader will systematically authenticate and load other elements of the system. In other, typically smaller applications, it could be the complete application that is loaded. The digital signature is a mathematical scheme for demonstrating the authenticity of digital data. A valid digital signature gives the recipient reason to believe that the data was created by a known source, referred to as authentication, that the sender cannot deny having sent the message, and that the data was not altered in transit or during storage, which provides integrity. The digital signature is typically created using a private public key cryptography. A hash value is calculated which uniquely represents the data being protected. This hash value is then signed with a private key that identifies the source of the data. The reader of the data will calculate its own hash value for the data. The reader will also authenticate the digital signature stored in the data stream using a public key associated with the private key. If the result of the authentication process matches the hash value calculated for the data, then it can be assumed that the data has not been altered and that it has been created by the owner of the private key. Public-private key cryptography provides a high degree of security, as only the public key has to be distributed within the medical devices and does not need storing in a secure private location, whereas the private key can be stored securely offline. However, if in the unfortunate event that the private keys were compromised, then a secure method would be required to update the public keys within the medical devices themselves. Medical systems need to authenticate all connecting devices and sources of data. Building a system whereby the true identity of all devices and data sources in the system can be validated. For example, a medical device may have attachments used to administrate treatment. The medical device has to ensure that only data received from approved attachments can be used, and in doing so prevent the use of malicious, clone, or counterfeit attachments. Likewise, if a medical device has internet connectivity, the medical device needs to demonstrate it is the true source of the data transmitted. This guards against man-in-the-middle attacks, whereby the attacker secretly relays and possibly alters the communication between the two parties who believe they are directly communicating with each other. This can be achieved by adding a digital signature to all messages transmitted. If the receiving device can authenticate the digital signature, then the sources of the messages can be confirmed and also its integrity. Building a trusted system relies on each device in the chain being able to authenticate the devices connecting to it. Encryption is used to protect data at rest or in transit. Data at rest may include patient records, which are considered highly confidential. It can also include the actual code image itself. Encryption and a digital signature can be used in combination. Encryption is used so attackers can't discover the plain text of a message or stored data. A digital signature is used to confirm the source and integrity of a message or stored data item. Typically, data is encrypted and then signed with a digital signature. If the receiving device can authenticate the digital signature, then the source of the message can be confirmed and also its integrity. The message or data object can then be decrypted and used by the remaining system. Software updates and patches allow medical devices to stay current, but could also introduce vulnerabilities. Software updates must be delivered from an authenticated source with an attached digital signature used to authenticate the code image, keeping systems in the field from being tricked into accepting malicious updates. However, additional features are required to close rollback vulnerabilities. Rollback is an attack strategy in which the attacker attempts to undo security updates by tricking the system into executing an authentic but old and vulnerable version of the system software. The system will also need to confirm that the latest version of the software is valid for its configuration. The smaller the attack surface, the less opportunity bad actors have for gaining control of the medical device. All data streams into the system that don't authenticate and encrypt data must be disabled. This prevents bad actors from circumventing the security measures already put in place and gaining easy access to the medical device via backdoor. It may be quite easy to forget to disable a port used for monitoring and setting the internal status of a medical device used during its validation process. Enabled JTAG ports offer an easy way into the system for bad actors that have acquired the medical device. JTAG is a common hardware interface that provides a way to communicate directly with a processor. JTAG is an extremely powerful interface to embedded devices and provides access to almost all of the processes' functionality, allowing bad actors to do, well, whatever they want to do. To guard against this type of attack, the JTAG interface should be removed from the board. However, it's best if the JTAG interface can be completely disabled. Unused or undocumented code sections may offer a backdoor into the system that no one was even aware of. It's important that all code segments that can be traced back, that all code segments can be traced back to a requirement, that each requirement has a test case associated against it, and that the test case tests each and every path through the code. For SafeRTOS, we use modified condition decision coverage as a metric to demonstrate all paths through the SafeRTOS code have been verified. 100% MCDC coverage means that there are no unused or undocumented code sections within the device itself, and that every path through the software has been tested. On smaller devices, running from flash rather than RAM provides a more secure option as well. By building in partitioning, it makes it harder for bad actors to obtain full access to the medical device. High security functionality, including key management, is typically implemented on the dedicated security module, implemented entirely in hardware or a combination of hardware and software integrated into a security coprocessor. Access to the security module is achieved via a restricted interface. This achieves a high degree of partitioning. Internal partitioning of the software using the processor's MPU or MMU can make life harder for bad actors to gain control of the system. For example, SafeRTOS has a task separation and isolation function that allocates each task to its own memory regions and provides user permissions. This prevents tasks from accessing memory outside of their allocated memory regions and prevents bad actors from quickly gaining control of the entire system. Alternatively, Armor have created Trust Zone and Synopsys have created Secure Shield, which both have a concept of secure and non-secure zones that are hardware separated. With non-secure software blocked from accessing secure resources directly, software is either loaded within the secure world or the non-secure world. Switching between these two zones is device-specific and achieved either by software or firmware. So, in conclusion, no one action will make medical device security, make a medical device secure. Only a holistic approach to security can reduce vulnerabilities in medical devices. Security has to be considered from the outset of the design process and needs to be reviewed and monitored across the lifetime of the product. Security relies on a series of nested objectives that build upon each other. That's it for me. Thank you very much for your time today. And I very much hope you found my insights into medical device security informative. Back to you, Kurt.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. I think there's a lot of great information there on encryption, security, vulnerabilities, and SafeRTOS architecture that was really interesting. I want to also remind the audience, take advantage of the expertise here. Keep asking those questions. We'll get to them at the end of the presentations. Next up is Mark. Mark.
Hello there. Hello, my name is Mark Pitchford. I'm from LDRA Technologies, and I want to talk to you today about security in medical devices. The standard IEC 62304 has been a point of reference for medical device development since its inception in 2006. The circle on this slide shows the example used in the standard. In it, a software system has been designated Class C. That system can be segregated into one software item to deal with the functionality of limited safety implications, software item X, and another to handle highly safety critical aspects of the system, software item Y. That principle can be repeated in a hierarchical manner, such that software item Y can itself be segregated into software items W and Z, and so on, always on the basis that no segregated software item can negatively affect another. In 2015, IEC 62304 was updated with the introduction of Amendment 1. One of the more subtle changes in 62304 was the introduction of an emphasis that the segregation of software of different classes need not be enforced by means of hardware. This is a very appealing concept, especially given that lesser classes mean lower development overhead. The segregation of software into domains of differing classes is not unique to medical devices, and it's useful to dip into the experiences of the automotive industry to understand why it is especially key in connected systems. This image is a very famous one for many people familiar with connected safety critical embedded software, even those outside the automotive industry. The article tells the story of how a couple of hackers, Charlie Miller and Chris Valasek, were able to remotely control a Chrysler Jeep Cherokee and drive it into a ditch. The more sophisticated a connected system becomes, the more extensive the attack surface gets. Imagine yourself reviewing an automotive design from the attacker's perspective. What would you attack? What would you try to get to? How would you plan your attack vector from the attack point to the target data? External access brings with it the potential for malicious outside influences to access any attack point. These attack points represent a significant risk even in a low or non-critical system because they provide access points to networks also used by the most critical systems. In stark terms, just because someone can hack into a car and infotainment system doesn't guarantee that they can't access the brakes. It is therefore important to prevent, as far as is reasonable, the access to safety-critical domains from those that are not more benign. The paper talks of there being no separation mechanism to protect the safety-critical element from outside interference. In practice, there are several ways to provide some degree of separation between different domains and yet still provide a level of communication between them. Jeep's painful experience is one we can learn from in medical devices. Here is a possible architecture for a heart pacemaker that deploys software separation technology to help optimize security in a medical device. This is a simplistic diagram, and there could be many more virtual machines here, each assigned the least privilege it can have in order to achieve its aims. So on the face of it, we've achieved the aim of separation. That was a fundamental flaw in the Jeep, we're told, so is that job done for our secure medical system? The principle of separation is sound in many ways, and there are several RTOS vendors operating their particular take on it. However, it would be a mistake to think that it can offer a defense against all possible cyber attacks. However separation is implemented through hardware or software, it offers merely a level of protection and not a complete solution to guarantee security. Neither a single technology, nor even any combination of technologies, can guarantee that. But a combination of technologies can minimize the risk. In order to address this security conundrum, it's useful to adapt an analogy from elsewhere in the world of medicine. In March 2000, Professor James Reason proposed a Swiss cheese analogy to explain how system accidents occur in medical environments. Many aspects of medical endeavor require human input and the inevitable human error that goes with it. But generally, there are so many levels of defense that for a catastrophe to happen, an entire sequence of failures is required such that none of the defenses prevent it. Professor Reason likened this principle to a sequence of slices of Swiss cheese, except in his model the holes in the slices were forever moving, closing, widening and shrinking. Just like the checks and controls applicable to medical systems, a multiple level approach to security makes a great deal of sense so that if the bad guys get past the first level of defense, there are others in wait. This adaptation of the Swiss cheese model illustrates why. No connected system is ever going to be both useful and absolutely impenetrable. It makes sense to protect it proportionally to the level of risk involved if it were to be compromised, and that means applying multiple levels of security so that if one level fails, others are standing guard. That's all very well, you might think. We can all apply every possible security precaution to every possible software architecture and application. But surely that would be disproportionately expensive. This is a house in Hertsville, Sydney, with 24 security cameras, 18 searchlights, and 2 reinforced steel gates. The 770 square meter single-story suburban fortress has roller shutters and bars on doors and windows. The security systems cost about $60,000, more than a third of the $160,000 paid for the house. We could design our embedded systems using such an approach, but would it be practical? And if not, how can only one judge what to apply and where? Let's return to our simple connected pacemaker. For that to be effective, there needs to be communication between the virtual machines. How will that be achieved? Well, we could emulate standard IP, but at that point you've got a very convenient bridge between different virtual machines. We could encrypt the data between them, but perhaps that would be too large a processing overhead. We could protect the interface through obscurity using a minimalistic bespoke protocol, but what if there are bad actors at large? Whichever way you go about this communication, it's vital that the code implementing it is secure to reinforce what can only be a weak point in the architecture itself. Examples of where code is highly critical, like this one, will be highlighted as part of the process of analysing the attack surface and will provide focal points for our efforts. So how can we ensure that the application code itself is secure? The CERT division of the Software Engineering Institute has evolved dramatically since it was created in 1988. CERT have recommended a total of 12 key practices for ensuring that application code is as secure as possible. I will pick out just a few examples and illustrate how they might be enforced in practice. By far the most important coding practice is to validate any data that comes from an unknown external source, perhaps an RS-232 port or user input. It requires that defensive code needs to be added to check not just that the data received is within the expected bounds, but also to make sure that the data makes sense. For example, denial of service attacks usually take the form of a legitimate command being repeated far more frequently than expected by the software designers. Here we see how a static analysis tool can help by highlighting unvalidated inputs. In this example, data is read from an external input, an ADC. Data flow analysis can be used to understand exactly where that data is used and manipulated and how. It is surprising just how many engineers ignore compiler warnings. It is recommended not just to use the highest warning level and ensure that the warnings are addressed, but also to use static and dynamic analysis tools to check for adherence to coding standards. It is important to minimize complexity. The higher the complexity of a code base, the more challenging it will be to understand, maintain, and test it effectively, and hence the more likely that the vulnerabilities will lie undetected. Numerous metrics can be measured, such as the number of lines of code or the fan-in, fan-out, but possibly the best-known metric is the McCabe cyclomatic complexity. This flow diagram illustrates a function with a low cyclomatic complexity of 4. Here we see an extract from the open source 7-zip software application. As can be seen, the function getOptimum has a cyclomatic complexity of 98, implying that it's too complex. You really don't want to have to try to understand, maintain, or test this code, and you can only have to look at the state of that flow diagram to understand why that would be a challenge. Most systems don't work independently. They usually pass data to some sort of data interface. So we need to make sure that data passed to each interface is sanitized, because usually the system generating the data has far more contextual information about that data than its recipient. So by sanitizing the data before it leaves the system, we can be more certain that the data has not been modified maliciously than by merely treating the problem as an input data issue. This SQL example shows how unsanitized data could be a problem. With the 1 equals 1 addition to the data string, that user ID check is bypassed. Note that this principle is important even in low criticality systems sending data to high criticality recipients, simply because the low criticality system has better knowledge, better information about what the data should actually look like than the recipient could ever have. After developing the code in accordance with the CERT recommendations, it would be easy to conclude that the work is now done. However, functional safety and security standards such as CWE, as shown above, reflect the need to exercise that code and provide evidence that the paths through it are proven to a degree commensurate with the criticality of the code, and that there is also no code that is surplus to requirements. Code that is surplus to requirements is particularly of interest for security applications because they may represent a backdoor method implemented by a rogue operator. So we have the fictional defensive software, and we also need to know that we've done enough testing and ensure that there is no additional software. We can achieve that by measuring structural coverage, that is, instrumenting the software code itself and ensuring that by checking that each of the application requirements have been tested, whether we have therefore tested all of the code associated with those requirements, and as importantly, that there is no code remains untested or unexercised despite the fact that all requirements have been covered. So I have a few parting thoughts to leave you with. First, we need to make every part of the system as secure as is practical, as is proportionate to the criticality of the system as a whole. We need to remember that security is a continuously moving problem as hackers find new techniques to breach defenses. It's wise to deploy multiple levels of security and defend weak architectural points by means of secure application code. And it's sensible to apply secure coding practices to ensure that code is secure, especially where the underlying architecture is potentially vulnerable. That concludes my presentation for today, so back to you, Kurt.
Great, thanks. I think we got a lot of great information on code validation and testing and the security elements involved with that as well, so that's great. We are now to the Q&A portion. Want to continue to encourage the audience to take advantage of the expertise we have here today and continue to ask those questions. Let's start with a question for Andrew. So as an RTOS provider, can you comment on the security features that are typically supplied by an RTOS?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, let me think. I'll toss a little task to be partitioned and isolated from each other using processors built in MPU or MMU feature. And this isolation builds in a level of security which sort of delays hackers penetrating the system quickly. The RTOS will also provide a high level of determinism upon which the security can be built upon. If you take Safe RTOS for instance, it's very, very highly deterministic. It's one of the key selling points for it. And also looking at Safe RTOS, it's very, very compact. It's between 10 and 16 Ks worth of ROM, which means it's got a very, very small attack surface, so we can make it deterministic, small and compact. Another thing to consider is not necessarily RTOS, but also the RTOS supplier. So it would be the length of the supply chain. How many third parties have contributed to the RTOS you're using? Are all these companies trustworthy? It's always a good gift. It's always good to keep your supply chain as short as possible and have visibility over it. This allows all code to be accounted for, removing opportunities for unknown backdoors and everything. So it's not just the RTOS, it's also the RTOS company, which is important to consider.
Okay, great. I think there's a follow-on question for that too, but I want to ask one for Mark here that's come in. Mark, you used a hypervisor as an example of a secure architecture. Now, is that the route that you're recommending? Is that the only route?
Not especially. I picked on that really because if you wander around any exhibition at the moment, any conference, any safety, security, critical gathering, it appears that hypervisors are something of a flavour of the month, if you like. They're very popular. It's a common sense, to some degree, route to go. But there are some questions surrounding them. For example, if you've got a denial of service on an application on running on low criticality on a virtual machine on a hypervisor, then what happens if that particular virtual machine gets bombarded? What happens if it gets exercised to such an extent that the device itself overheats? Because at that point, whether it's got direct access to data on a more critical virtual machine or not, it's going to compromise its ability to function. So it's not, what I'm trying to put across is that it is a sensible technology, it's a good way to go, it provides a good way of separating and separation method, but it's not a silver bullet. You need to think about other things too, and that's where secure coding can help.
I see. Yeah, so it's a combination of secure coding and some of the analysis techniques that you're talking about in addition to the foundational hypervisor separation inter-process communication stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, Andrew, now you mentioned in the previous questions answered, the MMU, et cetera. Now, there are also trust zones that you talked about in your presentation and other security techniques. How many of these features depend on the silicon the RTOS is running on? Does the RTOS require silicon support, or can it be emulated in software if it's not present? And you mentioned, the manufacturer of the RTOS. I mean, is it RTOS dependent? How do you approach that?
It's quite interesting coming from a safety background, because most people are happy for safety functions to be implemented in software themselves. But when it comes to security, it tends to be hardware which implements the security features, whether you have a coprocessor or a piece of firmware which is external to your main processor where all your keys are managed and all the encryption is done and you have a limited interface to it. But when we talk about partitioning with TrustZone and Synopsys Secure Shield or even the processor's MMU, MPU, it really comes down to the processor itself. The RTOS manufacturer gives you the tools to use the MPU or MMU in a way which can create isolation, but the actual mechanisms themselves are always provided by the firmware.
Okay, interesting. So, like in the Spectre and Meltdown vulnerabilities that had to do with people taking advantage of predictive branches and stuff like that, pretty complicated stuff that's in that silicon architecture. That's something that compilers can kind of deal with sometimes, or is that something to look for in RTOSes and the tool set in order to make sure you're starting with a secure foundation?
Yes, I'm aware that some of the fixes for Spectre and Meltdown are compiler fixes. There are other fixes out there from the various manufacturers that could be accessed from their websites itself.
Okay. Great. So, Mark, you talked about sanitizing data sent to other systems. Are you saying that I should do that even in low criticality systems? Or how do you gauge when you should be paying more or less attention to this?
Yes, I'm saying it's almost as important because it's a low criticality system that you're sending it from, particularly if the recipient is high criticality. And that's just because if you have a low criticality system, irrespective of the standard of the software that's written in that system, that system will have an inherent definition, an inherent knowledge of what the data it's supposed to be exporting should look like, and the parameters that it could, or the bounds within which it's supposed to sit. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily true that the recipient system will know that. So even if it's a very highly critical system that's been written accordingly to a very high standard and with lots of secure code and all the rest of it, it doesn't have that contextual information that says you're sending me a number that can't possibly be sensible in combination with what you told me 2 seconds ago. So there's the context, it has the context of the information that it's sending that no recipient system can necessarily have. And so for that reason, even if you're on a low criticality system, it's imperative that the data that's sent out of that system is checked before it goes.
That makes sense. So you don't get sloppy just because you think this is a low criticality component in and of itself because you don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean it's more to do with the actual data that's being passed out. It might not be the fact that the data itself might, the rest of the system might be not critical at all, but if it's passing data out to something that's going to regard it as important in a system that is critical, then we need to bear that in mind.
I see. Okay, that makes sense. Andrew, in your presentation, you describe the additional activities that are required to add security to a development lifecycle. I would like to know what you feel are the key similarities between safety and security.
I would have to say determinism is a key property for both safe and secure systems. In a safety system, it's obvious. When the system leaves its working context, it has to enter a safe state without fail, or otherwise life or the environment may be at stake. In a secure system, if your system does not respond in a deterministic way, you have to question why not. And can this non-deterministic behavior be caused by an underlying vulnerability? And could that vulnerability be exploited? Every time a system behaves in a way where it's not intended to, the side effects are also not known or not aware. You're not aware of what the side effects are. And that always provides vulnerabilities within a system which could be exploited.
Okay, interesting. So, yeah, I also want to let the audience know we do still have about 8 or 9 minutes, so please ask those questions, continue to ask them. Good. So, Mark, medical devices are starting to become more interconnected with standardized interfaces. Does this increase security risk to medical devices and how they can be addressed? I assume that it's standardized interfaces mean spoofing, unauthorized control. How do you close all those kinds of loops with the benefit of
I mean, it's a double-edged sword. The fact that things are easily, you can sort of plug and play almost between different devices, and the fact that they've got these standard interfaces means that by definition, the way that those interfaces work are obviously commonplace for everybody. But actually, just obscurity of itself doesn't necessarily guarantee anything, because yes, all right, the world at large won't necessarily know how those interfaces work, but it only takes one bad actor to divulge the information about that obscurity to someone, or take advantage of it, or sell it, or whatever.
Sure.
And you've got you're equally vulnerable. So relying on the obscurity itself isn't necessarily a wise path to follow. So it's back, I'm afraid, to doing things as securely as you possibly can, and particularly with regards to the data that's being passed from one part of the system to another. So the input data and the output data from your system are particularly vulnerable, and it's where really the secure coding practices should be at their optimum.
I see, that makes sense. So are the standards committees doing something about building in security, encryption, authentication into these interfaces, or are they just specking the ins and outs and data?
Well, there's obviously encryption being specified in various places. Andrew's spoken of encryption in his presentation. It's common sense to have encryption in very many places. In particular, we saw in that diagram I showed for the hypervisor, we showed an encrypted data being passed from the monitoring system through to the cloud, wherever the people sitting and monitoring that system would be. So encryption is a vital component, whether it's actually a vital part of the communications mechanism by definition is almost neither here nor there, as long as the encryption is in place in a sensible, defined manner.
Okay, that makes sense. Andrew, I think you were mentioning that determinism was the common property of security and safety, correct?
That's correct.
So there's a really good question that's come in about is it possible that the determinism of the system can lead to security risks all by itself because of the predictability? And if so, what techniques might be able to be used to prevent them? Is that possible?
I would say quite the opposite. The more deterministic the system is, the easier it is to analyze, the easier it is to predict its the consequences of a certain input or attack vector. So the more secure it would become. So quite the opposite. The greater the determinism, the more reliable the system works, the more repeatable it is, the easier it is to test and guard against and do your risk assessment, and the harder it is to gain access to it.
I see. So does that lead to a possible attack vector, like to attack the predictability assumption itself? Like if they're becoming more predictable, trying to inject something to make the real time or the deadline boundaries of the software not hit quite right and could cause unpredictable results?
Not really. The greater the determinism, the easier it is to test and verify your system and validate your system, and all your work your pen testers do and your fuzz testers do just sort of build in extra security itself. So I'd say the greater the determinism of the system, the lower the risk factor is for people to get in. It's only when systems start misbehaving, or if you go back to Spectre, can be predicted or it can be loaded in a way to circumvent certain instruction preloading routines, when you get your vulnerabilities in a highly determined system, it should be okay.
I see.
Yeah, can I step in on that one as well, please? A typical example of where you get non-determinism is if you've got something overstepping the end of an array, which is or stepping over the boundary, memory boundary somehow. You will get non-deterministic behavior from that because something else somewhere is probably using the memory that you've trampled all over by going over the end of your array.
Right.
So you don't know what the outcome of that's going to be. It's going to be pretty unpredictable what behavior it's going to influence.
Right.
If somebody gets to be able to compromise that from a security perspective, then obviously they are potentially in a position to take advantage of that, the memory that's being overloaded or being overwritten, and have the system do what they would like it to do, or at least not have it do what it's supposed to do. And that symptom is also a very common symptom from a safety perspective, again, from the non-deterministic perspective, because if you don't know what your system's going to do, then how can you know that it's going to behave safely? So as Andrew was saying earlier, it's one of the things that is common to both, because you don't know what the system's going to do and therefore it can't be safe. And if somebody does manage to compromise the memory that's being overwritten, they may be able to dictate what it does, and that can't be secure.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Here's an excellent question that came in, and I'm not sure if we covered this dimension, but it's a good one. Can you comment on possible mechanisms to detect an injection or attack? Maybe you can start, Andrew, and Mark, you can follow.
Okay, so from an RTOS perspective, you obviously have tasks, and tasks communicate with one another. So you could build in a penetration detection routine within your RTOS to identify when tasks start talking or start interacting to other parts of the system they're not supposed to. This could be awareness to the application that maybe something's going on that's not expected to go on. And from that, warning flags could be set higher up the system. So it's a case of the designer knows what tasks talk to each other, and when the deterministic behavior is no longer deterministic, that's when the warnings are set. So you can get detection monitors for quite a few RTOSes these days, and they tend to work on them in similar manners.
I see, okay. Mark, any strategies for that from you?
I think that whole strategy that Andrew's just described would then be complemented by, because that would be critical code. That would be code that was highly critical to ensuring the system was safe, and therefore that code itself would be the ideal target to have the maximum secure coding techniques, or the optimal secure coding techniques applied to that mechanism. So the mechanism itself is inherently designed to be secure stroke safe. But if that's not, so that makes it a prime target for somebody to attack it. So it's particularly vital that that code is secure.
I see. So they go hand in hand. You're talking about identifying and detecting these things, using runtime monitors to detect these kinds of things, and then coupling that with and complementing it with the strategies to make sure that you're doing test and analysis, code analysis across that.
Yeah,
that's precisely it.
Great.
As Mark said earlier, there's no silver bullet. You have to take a holistic approach across all fronts to build in security.
Exactly, and I think that's a great message to end on. Unfortunately, we do have reached the end of our eCast. I want to thank Andrew and Mark for sharing your insights on security for medical devices. We at Open Systems Media, LDRA, and Wittenstein also thank you, the audience, for attending and contributing excellent questions today. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast version will also be made available there. This and all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Thanks for attending, and have a great day.